Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King starts things off. 12 days and counting till Congress goes on its summer recess. Will they do anything about the refugee crisis at our southern border? We'll also discuss Elizabeth Warren, superstar. Then Ed Maloney, the head of the Belfast Project, Boston College's oral history of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, joins us to discuss how he thinks the college's release of some of the interviews to British authorities strikes a blow at academic freedom and puts lives at risk.
Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School on the demise of a famed cupcake shop. We'll ask you, does this mean the single product store is doomed, or could some, say a grilled cheese emporium, live forever? Then our TV guru, Bob Thompson, on the Emmys and how Seinfeld, 25 years after its debut, still reverberates on TV and in our culture. All that coming up on 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. A month ago, no one foresaw that immigration would be an issue dogging President Obama. As of today, many would suggest it's even more pressing than the crisis in the Middle East. At the southwest border, as you know, authorities have apprehended tens of thousands of unaccompanied kids. Both Republicans and Democrats see the president as not acting with enough urgency. And the people of the United States are equally frustrated. A new poll finds that 6 out of 10 Americans disapprove of how the president is handling this immigration emergency. Joining us on the line now to go over this and other political headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, as you know, also hosts Inside Politics. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. Yet another issue in a very, very tough year for the president. But I think you hit the key point, Jim. What makes this one different is it's bipartisan in terms of the poking from Congress. There are conservative Democrats who think he was asleep at the switch and didn't see this coming and should have. There are liberals now who are getting mad that the president says he's going to send most of these kids and their family members home. And the Republicans, of course, are saying, you know, we're not going to give you your nearly $4 billion. So he's got a huge political fight that's causing him trouble across the country.
Well, we only have a few days, John King, until Congress is going to recess. So what are the prospects of getting something accomplished here?
It's a great question. Look, the president, you know, one piece of leverage he does have is he can say, hey, you're not going anywhere until we figure this out, or at least figure out the urgent pieces about getting money for a surge of Border Patrol folks, a surge of these hearings to, you know, get these cases adjudicated more quickly. There's beginning to see pieces of possible compromise. You know, Congressman Cuellar, the Democrat conservative who's been critical of the president from Texas, and Senator Cornyn, a Republican, who's always very critical of the president. They have a proposal. Mostly, the centerpiece of that is it does away with that 2008 law that guarantees most of these kids a hearing, a legal process. There's some other steps in there. A House group is proposing some stuff today. The administration has its ideas. Now, normally, you say this is a crisis. You take all those pieces of paper, and you go into a room, and you figure it out. Washington hasn't been normal in a very long time. But let's see over the next 72 hours if they can figure some of this out.
You know, it's funny. I said to Marjorie as we were talking to you earlier this morning, I said, you know, unlike every other problem that they're not dealing with, which is virtually every problem, this is one that they actually have to fix before they go home. And I think, Marjorie, your response to me was, why? They don't fix anything else. But I am right. This they have to. I don't mean have to as a moral imperative. This has got to be addressed. Correct? Everybody agrees with that. No?
Everybody agrees that what you said just makes perfect sense. However, I live in Washington, and it has not made anywhere near, never mind perfect sense. It hasn't made imperfect sense in a long time. But, you know, look, you can. I do think that if the president is willing to negotiate with Republicans, at some point, you know, the question is, will they take yes for an answer? He says he wants to send most of these children home. The left doesn't like that, but the president says that's what he wants to do. That's what the Republicans want. The president, the Republicans would argue, has not paid any attention to the border for the last 5.5 years. Guess what? They've got his attention now. The president wants more Border Patrol. Republicans have said we need more resources on the border. The president says he thinks the National Guard's a bad idea, but he's open to it if the Republicans insist on it, at least in the short term. So if the president keeps, you know, going down this list and telling the Republicans yes, or mostly yes, at what point, you know, do they have to say yes? I do think there is a risk. Look, they think this issue helps them. They think it's another issue in which the American people say, you know, where's the competence, where's the management skills of this administration? But to your point, if they went home, I think then, you know, a president who's a pretty good communicator could use the bully pulpit to say, you know, a pox on everybody. They just took off and, you know, left me with no tools to deal with this problem.
We're talking with John King from CNN. You know the old cliche, John, picture's worth a thousand words. What I don't understand in this case is how the Border Patrol is preventing cameras, as I'm sure you've tried to get in there from CNN, or photographers to go in and shoot pictures of these children unless they're seen from behind and all this, but about their privacy and stuff. But Getty Images has run a couple, and just the couple that Getty Images have run, you see young, you know, preteens, I don't know, teenagers, you can't really tell how old they are, lying on the floor or lying in mass. I can't help but think if the Obama administration managed to open up these detention centers to the public and people actually saw these pictures, it would have a big impact.
I do think what is interesting, you're right, we've seen very few pictures. The ones that we do get that are more clear tend to come from immigrant rights activist groups. We had a crew on the ground when they actually sent a plane full, the first plane full, I believe, back to Honduras yesterday. CNN had a crew there to show you people getting off a plane. Now, the administration wants those pictures out because they want to send the message that most of these people are going to be sent home, and they hope that that resonates and that people stop sending their kids to the border. But what's so interesting about this, Marjorie, is what I'll call the lack of compassion in the rhetoric, in the sense that let's assume for the sake of argument, you know, maybe a lot of people out there listening don't think they should all be sent back, but let's just accept that for the point of the argument, that we're going to send, you know, 80-90% of them back. But to your point, they're still children, and they've been through hell to get to where they are, most of them, to go through Mexico after coming from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and so they need just basic humanitarian deserve health coverage. I do think what's missing from this, and the coarseness of it is fascinating, is that, okay, even if we're going to send them all back, let's set up humane detention centers. Let's get them the health care they need. Maybe that comes from volunteers. You know, there's a legitimate question about how much should the federal government pay here. I get that. But you've got, you know, Glenn Beck going down there with soccer balls and teddy bears. And, you know, he seems to be the most compassionate voice on the right. I do think there's a risk for the Republican Party, if you seem too coarse about this. But let's also be honest. The Democrats, Martin O'Malley, the governor of Maryland, who's thinking about running for president, he has gone to the left of most Democrats. Hillary Clinton says send them back. Barack Obama says send them back. Martin O'Malley has said, whoa, let's think about this. That's an interesting play by a guy who might be trying to run in 2016 to the left of Hillary Clinton. But otherwise, the Democrats who are jumping up and down are mostly Democrats who are either retiring from the Senate, Tom Harkin of Iowa for one, or not on the ballot this year. But remember, last week, I think we talked about the toast the president had with the governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper. They clinked beer glasses together. Hickenlooper says, don't send them to my state. I don't want a detention center in my state. So he's on the ballot this year. A lot of Democrats are, I don't mean to say cold-hearted. I get the idea that, you know, they're illegally entering the country. I get all that. But they're kids, and you would think there'd be a little compassion before we sent them home.
Well, you talk about Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, a Democrat. He's got this pretty upsetting quote when he says, quote, we are not a country that should turn children away and send them back to certain death, unquote, he said at this governor's association meeting. And I mean, you know, that's why I think if we saw pictures, I mean, that would make a big difference, because you can't be, they are children. I don't know exactly how old all these kids are, but they don't look very old to me.
Yeah, our correspondent on the ground in Honduras said of the plane that came back yesterday, they called them, I think, 18 family units, meaning, you know, it was a parent or an aunt or an uncle and several kids, so there could be three or four people as one family unit. But she said there were teenagers and there was one baby as young as 6 months old that came off the plane. Now, you know, Governor O'Malley might be guilty of a little hyperbole. You know, not all of them maybe are going to face near death or face violent crime when they go back, but the law was passed in 2008, and this is my point about looking in the mirror. It passed unanimously. So there are a lot of Republicans in the House. There are a lot of Republicans in the Senate, a lot of Democrats in both chambers, too, who went along with this law in 2008, who are now jumping up and down saying, you know, send them back yesterday. Well, you know, you passed the law. You're responsible for this, whether you like it or not. And there are unintended consequences. Sometimes you have to go back and fix things. But as you start screaming at, you know, whether it's the Department of Homeland Security or the President of the United States or the Border Patrol or these kids, some of them might need to take a breath and look in the mirror.
You know, John, we've discussed with you many a time the huge margin that Barack Obama had over Mitt Romney with Latinos, 71-29. This recent ABC, I think it's Washington Post poll, 60% disapproval for the president amongst the general population. on this issue and dealing with immigration in general. 54% of Latinos are unhappy with what he's done. The only good news for the president is an even higher percentage are unhappy with the Republicans in Congress. Does this have potential, if this lingers for a while, to erode what the Democrats see as one of their great Trump cards come 2016, the support of Latinos? And remember, I mean, you remember better than anybody, this is one of the major pledges the president made running for re-election and running the first time, that he was going to fix the immigration thing. And while he may say it's the Republicans' fault, he's the man at the top. Is that advantage eroding over this?
It is eroding for him. If you look at individual races, there's some new polling out today on the Senate race in Colorado and the Senate race in Michigan. And if you look into the polling there, the Democrats are still doing much better among non-white voters, including Latino voters. But I do think there is certainly the potential for that, Jim. The question is, can the Republicans take advantage of that? And that's why, to Marjorie's point a few minutes ago, it is interesting to watch, you know, the Republican, in a sentence, the Republican strategy seems to be, this is the president's fault, send them home now. And you could, you know, you could say this is the president's fault, but these, remember when George W. Bush and I believe John McCain used the term God's children?
I do.
You could say this is the president's fault, and most of these children need to go home. But let's make sure, you know, we honor the values of America first and check on their health and make sure they're well fed and make very well sure that we've connected them with a family member back home before we send them back. I think it's, making that argument would sound a lot more kinder and gentler. To borrow from another Bush. But the, look, we're 100 days away from an election. Everybody's panicked about the base because it's a midterm year and turnout is traditionally low. And so you've got this, you know, everything gets put into this political stew, and it's inevitable because the election is getting so close. But to your point about the president, look, there's so much disappointment. He promised to introduce a bill in the first year, and he's right, the Republicans wouldn't take it up, but he never introduced the bill. You know, he could have, We would have called it a show, you know, or stunt. But he could have given more speeches. He could have screamed at them and pushed them more to do it, and he didn't. Then he has all these deportations. So the Latino community is mad at this president. Now they're mad at him again because he says most are going to be sent home. The question is, will they be that mad at Hillary Clinton, who says send them home too? Who's the Republican candidate in 2016? So you can't really judge the long-term impact until we know the other side's putting up there.
John King from CNN, since Barack Obama does not have to get reelected, and since he has been amenable to comprehensive immigration reform, why is he saying most of them got to go home? Couldn't he be, without having to face reelection, a beacon of compassion here too?
Well, I think, number one, you know, the 2008 law was passed in the idea of trafficking.
Right, human trafficking.
Whether for labor or for trafficking or, you know, and so the president, when he says, most, you know, he doesn't think that's how most of these kids are ending up at the border. They're being sent here more for economic opportunity to be reunited with families here. So that is his argument. You can agree or disagree with that. You're right. As president, he certainly could say, we have this law. This might be a little bit different circumstances, but here they are. We're going to be, you know, America and let them in. I think the fact that he's not saying that tells you a lot about the politics of the moment. And it tells you, again, if you look at go through the 14 states, you know, that the 14 Democratic held Senate seats that the Republicans are targeting this year. And there's 14, they probably have a chance at 10 of those 14, but they're spending money in 14 of those races. If you went through those 14 races and watched what the Democrats were saying about this, that would tell you everything you need to know about the politics of immigration.
Well, you know, there's also an issue, a practical issue, is just like we all say, if for those who want to send 11, 12 million people who are illegally home, how do you do that? How do you find families and lives for 50 to 60,000 kids in the United States? You know, John, assuming that immigration is a foreign policy issue, which it obviously is, let's talk about foreign policy for a minute. My reaction to the new press secretary, whose name is just fabulous for the president, Josh Earnest, he had a Baghdad Bob moment the other day when he said that Obama was bringing tranquility to the globe. A columnist for the Washington Post wrote this morning. Iraq and Syria civil wars. We obviously know what's happening with Israel and the Palestinians, Afghanistan, Russia, Ukraine, Iran, everything. Is there any piece of our foreign policy that is going as the administration and John Kerry would want it to go, John?
You're forgot the Canadians are mad over the Keystone Pipeline.
I forgot. Oh, I'm forget sorry. Them. My apologies.
Yeah. I hope they don't invade.
All politics is local. Look, you know, we could treat this as T-ball. We could treat, how do you want to say? Look, Josh, that's a job. And whether it's a Democrat or Republican, I covered the White House for 9 years, and I'm around the White House a little bit. Not as much as I used to be now, but over my career here. And that's one of the toughest jobs in Washington. So I guess I'll say cut them a little slack.
Okay.
You know, the world's a mess right now. And again, if you, this is not always fair, but, you know, politicians run and they say things. And then we silly people in the news media and sometimes voters actually go back to what they said and say, well, how's that going? And one of the things he said was that after 8 years of George W. Bush, he was going to improve our standing in the world. And when people respected the United States more, you could get more done and you would reach agreements on these things. And there would be, you know, more peace and less disruption. Again, he can't control ISIS. He can't control the fact that Nouri al-Maliki is a thug. He can't control that Hamid Karzai and now what's going to happen in the future of Afghanistan is a mess. So you can't say that's Barack Obama's fault. Can you say, you know, like this border crisis, they should have, you know, had more pots on the oven. They should have been dealing with it sooner. Maybe they should have three secretaries of state because John Kerry can only be in one place at a time. Yeah, you can make those arguments. You can criticize pieces of, you know, and they can fire back at you. But right now, you cannot, with a straight face, stand behind that podium and say the world is a more tranquil place. I think even Josh knows that that's in the Josh part of his name, not the article.
Very good, John King. But, you know, I mean, the in this Dan Amilbat piece in the Washington Post, he quotes Ed Hemery, reporter for Fox News, talking about this Wall Street Journal piece and asking for a reaction to the notion that the president is a bystander in all these crises. And even if you like Barack Obama and voted for him twice, you might have that same sort of sense that he is a bystander.
In some cases, he is a bystander by choice. In other cases, he is a bystander because, you know, people won't listen to him. And so I do think, look, I think they're trying in a number of ways. There are some people who criticize the United States. It was mostly Secretary Kerry, but he works for President Obama. Why did he try to get the Israelis and the Palestinians back at the table when that, you know, you sort of knew it wasn't going to work? Well, I give him credit for trying. It did collapse. It collapsed. But he tried. And I applaud anybody who takes on the hard one. One of the criticisms of Secretary Clinton was that she traveled the world and built up goodwill because she was sort of a celebrity Secretary of State, but did she tackle the hard one? And I give, this is not a home state plug, you know, I give Secretary Kerry, who hasn't had a lot of successes, I give him credit for trying, because he'll be judged, quote-unquote, failure when those things don't work. He's done something in that this Afghan crisis where they, it appears at least that, you know, the two presidential candidates have agreed to this recount process.
Yeah.
We'll see if that one works. But when you look at Syria, when you look at Hamas, when you look at, you know, we're not even talking about the China challenge, which is ripe in there. The world's a messy place right now. And he's the president. And, you know, he's not always to blame. It's not always his fault. But we have one CEO. And so he's accountable and responsible because he's the president.
You know, speaking of responsible and speaking, we started with how he's being attacked from the left and the right, Democrats and Republicans, on this border crisis. On your television show, you talked about another mess he finds himself in the middle of. We talked about this the other day because Gordon College was the president of Gordon College in Wenham, was one of the 15 signers of a letter a day after Hobby Lobby decision came down asking for an exemption from a planned executive order from the president that would ban employment discrimination against gays and lesbians. And the point was made on your show that the president is between the proverbial rock and the hard place. On one hand, gay rights activists. On the other hand, religious organizations. How does he split this baby? Where does he end up here?
Well, we're waiting for the order from the White House, and they've had a lot of pressure from both sides. And so, you know, on the one hand, the lawyers would tell you the Supreme Court has spoken, so we need to carve out a religious exemption of some kind. And if you're the Obama White House and you believe in LGBT rights, you try to carve out as narrow an exemption as possible, and the community will still be mad at you. The other alternative is to not carve out any exemption, knowing that you're going to get sued, and you're probably going to lose because the Supreme Court is going to point at the Hobby Lobby decision and say, we told you. That there is a valid, you know, exemption here. So we're waiting to see what they do. And, you know, there will be competing pressures again, both on policy grounds and on that election that's sneaking up on us. By all accounts, they are, you know, trying to come up with an exemption, a religious exemption that is narrowly and specifically tailored. But the fact that we're waiting for this tells you that, you know, they're having a hard time getting everybody to agree and getting the lawyers to find something they think is palatable and defensible, and getting the political people to sign off on it, including up to the president. This is a hard one. And so if you look at it in that regard, sorry to ramble, going to have another argument about this, and the LGBT community is most likely going to be, disappointed in the president for carving out this exemption, assuming that's what he does. The way I also look at this, so if you put your head down in the fight of the moment, it's going to get messy again. If you lift your head up a little bit, this is how I urge people to think about this. And I'm not old enough to remember some of this, or just barely, but if you think about how long the civil rights movement took and how long the women's rights movement took, in 2004, George W. Bush won re-election. The last paragraph of his speech to drive out the vote in places like Ohio, where they had these constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage on the ballot.
Yeah. That's a great point.
He won a presidential election, in part using his opposition to same-sex marriage. So if you fast forward, only 10 years. We're only 10 years removed from that presidential election, and think of how different the world is. And so for those who want the president to go all the way, if he doesn't give you everything you want, I understand the frustration. And this debate will continue. It will continue after Barack Obama, when the next Democratic primaries and the next Republican set of primaries. So in the short term, we're going to have another dust up, clearly. If you lift and look at the horizon, pretty remarkable how much progress we've made on these issues in a decade.
We're talking to John King from CNN. John, I know you're familiar with Wes Roxbury. But Senator Elizabeth Warren was not in West Roxbury, but West Virginia over the weekend, campaigning for U.S. Senate hopeful Natalie Tennant. Listen to Warren.
The way I see this, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, and all those other guys on Wall Street, they've got plenty of folks in the United States Senate who are willing to work on their side. We need some more people willing to work on the side of America's family.
You know, we discussed this with you last week. It wasn't West Virginia. I forget what other. Oh, it was Kentucky that she was in campaigning for the Democrat. Here's what the Washington Post says. Here in West Virginia, an early stage for Democrats with national ambitions going back to JFK in 60, Warren was greeted as a progressive hero with several attendees pleading with her to run for president. There's a point at which one can't say anymore, this is just a loyal populist Democrat supporting her sisters and brothers. There's got to be more something going on here, doesn't there, John King?
Well, she was actually trying to get to West Roxbury, but she had too many of Doyle and JP in the wrong way. When she came out, ended up in West Virginia, it happened. She likes this and she's enjoying this. That has been my question. My colleague Peter Hamby was actually in Shepherdstown, West Virginia yesterday, and that's why I was asking him this morning, both on television and then after, because I couldn't be there. And I like to look them in the eye. I like to be in the room. I like to see how much they like to engage the crowd. And he says she's not a rope. And Robert Koster of the Washington Post, another great young reporter, says she's not a rope line person. She doesn't like to get in there like Bill Clinton and hug everybody. But she loves being up on the stage and pumping her fist. And I think it's important. Look, she insists she's not running for president. I assume she would think again if Hillary Clinton, for whatever reason, and I don't see this happening, but if Hillary Clinton said no, I think Elizabeth Warren would quickly reconsider. But so then to what end? Whether she runs for president or not, the Democratic Party, post-Barack Obama, this is starting to a degree now, but look what's happening to the Republicans. It accelerates and gets louder and sometimes usually messier and sometimes nasty once the president leaves, because there's always some loyalty and respect to the president. So whether it's Gitmo, whether it's drones, whether it's economic policy that Elizabeth Warren talks about and being too cozy with Wall Street, the Democratic Party is going to have this debate between the New Dealers and the New Democrats. And she's a New Dealer. And so she wants the leader of that push. Whether she's on a ballot for president or not, she wants to be the voice of that push. And she has quickly asserted herself, as a national figure for someone who's been in the Senate such a tiny amount of time. And so it's clear to me that this is not an accident anymore. And it's not just her staff or the Democratic National Committee saying, you've got to help us. They want you out there. I think she is being a loyal Democrat. I think she understands the fundraising draw that she is. But I also think she likes it and that she wants to influence the future of the party. And guess what? She's got a platform.
Well, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, she hits the bases that people obsess about when they wake up in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning. We used to joke up here when she was running for Senate how many times she would say that, talk about the hammered middle class, the hammered middle class, the hammered middle class. But the middle class is hammered. And so you can't, you know, you can't afford to take a vacation. You can't afford to send your kids to college. She's hitting on all those bases. And you think, John, when you think of different politicians, when you say Hillary Clinton, what does Hillary Clinton stand for? Well, I'm not really sure. A bunch of things. A lot of people would, I mean, everybody knows what Elizabeth Warren stands for. She's got that brand. And I've seen her on the stump here in Massachusetts. I mean, she is, even though you're right, she doesn't go and shake everybody's hand in the crowd. She's got this real rock star. I felt bad for her when she was out stumping with Ed Markey, who's also our senator here in Massachusetts. Poor Ed was over in the corner, like being totally overlooked. And Elizabeth Warren is just, you know, lapping up the adoration because people relate to what she's talking about.
And she's, listen, you know, this has been the defining debate of the last several presidential elections, and it will be again in 2016. But at a time when people don't trust Washington, and a time when most people, you know, think, and you've got a growing libertarian streak in the Republican Party, don't do things in Washington, solve them at the state level, she's making a case for an activist federal government. That's a tough case to make right now, beyond the hardcore base of the Democratic Party. Because, you know, Republicans would say Washington's not Washington's job. Republicans would say Washington doesn't have the money. A lot of Democrats say, you know, Washington hasn't proven it can do these things, and if we're going to still have a Republican House and an evenly divided Senate either way, you know, a lot of this is going to have to be done at the state level. So it's just fascinating to watch because, you know, the Democratic Party post-Obama, you're not going to have an African-American on the ballot. You might have the first female candidate for president, but this is a fascinating time and a fascinating moment for the party, both in terms of as when Barack Obama yields the stage and just generationally of the future of the Democratic Party. So I'm fascinated by her. I just, you know, I don't think they can win that West Virginia Senate race, but they certainly have the people they've been losing. And look, remember, Dukakis won West Virginia, then Gore lost it, and the Democrats haven't won it, you know, since then, is white working-class people. And that's what the room was packed. Peter Hamby told me the room was packed with white working-class people. In states like that, that's been the Democratic Party's problem. So if she has some magic potion, you know, Democrats are going to watch closely.
Okay, so John King, what are you going to withdraw when the Red Sox are not playing? It's the All-Star break. We talked to you last week. You were kind enough or something enough to admit that essentially at the end of your workday, you watch the Red Sox every single night. What do you watch, the Home Run Derby? What do you do for 3 days?
Skipped the Home Run Derby last night. I was reading books with my son, who was up a little past his bedtime, 3 years old now. My older son, who's up there in Boston, turned 21 yesterday.
So happy birthday.
Good for him. I told him to throw the fake ID out. Now he can use the real one.
It's amazing how good they are, isn't it?
It is. But I was reading with my little guy, Jonah. And after that conversation last week is when they dropped Przinsky and, you know, went to the youth movement. Remember, I said start the second half. I think Ben Sherrington said, never mind, let's just go now. It's hard. You know, I hope they rally in the second half. The math tells you it's really hard to do. You know what? I'm loyal to the end, so I'll watch until they're mathematically eliminated, and I'll probably keep watching anyway to see how the kids do. I will say this. I love the Derek Jeter ad with John Lester at the very beginning.
Oh, it's great. With everybody tipping their hat.
Yeah, I hate the Yankees, but what a class act Derek Jeter has been, and this is his last All-Star game tonight, and so I love that. I just have great respect for somebody who just gave his love and his life and his body to the game and did it the right way.
And by the way, for those who haven't seen this piece, and you will see it in the next 24 hours, the All-Star game, and he's leading off for the American League. It's his final All-Star game. He's retiring at 40. It's an endless succession of hat tipping from Spike Lee to Rudy Giuliani to just average people on the street in New York City to a couple of Red Sox fans at the bar, you know, sort of reluctantly tipping their Reds. It's a great piece.
Wait a minute. I agree. People tipping their hat to Jeter?
To Jeter. And it starts with Lester on the mound tipping his hat to Jeter. It's terrific. Hey, John, it's great to talk to you as always. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care, guys.
Thank you, John. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. He also hosts Inside Politics, which you can see every Sunday morning at 8:30. Up next, another angle of the Boston College Belfast Oral History Project. Ed Maloney, the former director of that endeavor, joins us for his take on what happened. That's coming up next on 89.7 WGBH. Mm-hmm.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, who do we welcome into our country and why? The Curiosity Desk compares our border with Mexico to the rest of the world. That's tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on? More great stuff on WGBH through our vehicle donation program. Visit wgbh.org/car donation.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Boston Children's Hospital, with suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts. Their community of care is always close to you. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well. And Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick, a law firm with a national practice focused on long-term disability, life insurance, and veterans benefits. You can find Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick online at cck-law.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're going to try to give you the latest developments and backstory to the Boston College Belfast Oral History Project in maybe 45 seconds or fewer. For 5 years, as you probably know, BC collected interviews with those who were part of the sectarian violence that ruled Northern Ireland. These interviews were done with assurances given to the interviewees that everything would remain confidential. But as you probably know, in 2011, the federal government subpoenaed BC, and ultimately the school handed over some of these interviews to British authorities, who were investigating the murder of a widowed mother of 10, Jean McConville, and ultimately it resulted in the arrest of the leader of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, and threatened, according to many, a still fragile peace. Globe columnist Kevin Cullen went to Belfast to follow up on the repercussions of the Oral History Project run amok. Many of the participants feel that their lives are threatened. Kevin joined us last week, fresh from his trip to Belfast. And one of the arguments Cullen made was that BC, because of something called the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty between the U.S. and Britain, could have exercised political exemptions, which would have enabled, according to Kevin, BC to resist the subpoena. The next day, the director of public relations for BC, Jack Dunn, joined us to dispute some of Cullen's assertions. And after that broadcast, we heard from Ed Maloney. Ed's the man who spearheaded and directed BC's Belfast project. He joins us possibly to set the record straight, hopefully at least to better align it. Ed, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for joining us. You know, before we, I just want to play a clip from Jack Dunn from Boston College, who was on with us, as Jim just said. And Jack Dunn said that the blame should be spread around for this terrible situation to many people, including you. Let's hear a piece of that sound.
I think the blame for this should go to all those who are involved in the attempt by Mr. Maloney and Mr. McIntyre to deflect blame from themselves and put it on the hands of Boston College so it doesn't hold up to the light of scrutiny.
Do you think that's an unfair statement, Ed Maloney?
I do. Yes, I do. Not surprisingly, and not just because we're on the receiving end of Jack Dunn's tirades since this subpoena business started. But there are, you know, there are valid reasons for thinking that we were misled by Boston College at a very crucial stage into going into this project, when if we had been treated properly and honestly, we would not have gone into this project.
And let me be clear, Ed, if I can be clear, when you say misled.
Can I explain, please? When we drew up the donor's contract, which is the contract that the interviewees would sign, which guaranteed their confidentiality and said to them that they were the only people who would be allowed to open or read these interviews outside of Boston College until their death. I asked the librarian at Boston College, Bob O'Neill, to run this wording past the college lawyer to make sure that we were in accordance with all our legal responsibilities. And I was given assurance that he would, and that eventually that he did. We have learned in the last few months or so, after 3 years of this subpoena fight, that in fact Bob O'Neill was lying to us, that he never ran the wording or the contract past the lawyers, that the contract should have included wording which made it clear that there were legal limits to confidentiality. And I can assure you, and I'm talking on behalf not just of myself, but also of Mr. McIntyre, but also of Wilson MacArthur, who did the interviews for the Ulster Volunteer Force interviewees, that if that wording had been, as it should have been, put in, as Bob O'Neill had a responsibility to ensure that it was put in, we would not have participated in this project, and we would not be sitting here today having this conversation. Sorry, no, I interrupted you.
No, it's fine. I'm glad I was just going to ask you to explain, and you did, Ed Maloney, who obviously was head of the project. You also contend, and we had this discussion in some depth with Jack Dunn when he was here last week, that Boston College didn't fight hard enough the subpoenas. And for those who haven't been paying attention to this, it was initiated by British authorities, went through the U.S. the United States Department of Justice, and ultimately the subpoenas were issued. Jack Dunn told us he thought they fought as hard as they could. You're not in the same place as he is, correct?
Absolutely not. I mean, first of all, when this whole thing started, the signals from Boston College quite clearly, quite loudly were that they would have given up the interviews without any sort of legal fight. When I discovered the existence or the serving of these subpoenas entirely by chance when a friend at Boston College rang me up to let me know that the subpoenas had been served, but also, you know, to warn me that, you know, I was not to endanger his privacy by revealing that I had been told this by him, because the atmosphere in the college was such that no one was going to know about these subpoenas except the college authorities, which meant essentially that those of us who had been involved in the project, as well as the people who had given the interviews, would not know about these subpoenas except for this one phone call. The first that we would have heard, I suspect, of the subpoenas would have been when people were arrested in Belfast, because I strongly suspect that Boston College was preparing to hand over these interviews until I got that phone call. I then made repeated attempts to contact Nora Field, who is the Boston College, one of the Boston College attorneys dealing with it, and was eventually told, of course, I only had one question to ask her, really, aside from asking how on earth this thing had happened. It wasn't supposed to have happened. But the main question after that would have been, is Boston College going to fight? The message I got back from her was that she did not want to speak to me. And that set the tone for the relationships between ourselves and Boston College ever since. And it planted a very strong seed of suspicion in my mind and in the mind of the other researchers that Boston College was getting ready to hand these interviews over. And because of that suspicion, and to force Boston College's hand, I then leaked the story to the New York Times. The New York Times had the story on the front page the next very next day, and within a few days, Boston College had been obliged to hire a lawyer to resist and to fight the subpoenas. But I wonder whether they would have ever taken on that lawyer if I had not taken the step of contacting the New York Times. And then when we did get to the legal fight, it went in front of Judge William Young at the Federal District Court in Boston. Boston College lost at that point. Jack Dunn then announced to the world that Boston College would not be appealing, would not go to the First Circuit Court of Appeals, would not take it any higher than Judge Young. Obviously, what was open to Boston College was a route that went all the way to the Supreme Court if they could get there. But no, they had decided that at that very early stage that they were going to give up. We who were the only ones who were really campaigning publicly, and this is against the background of Boston College trying to gag us, warning us that we'd be cut off from all flows of information if we continued going to the media with our campaign. We created such a fuss that Boston College was obliged to go back into the fight, not to reopen the whole case, but to fight on almost a technicality, which was about the number of interviews that had been handed over or were going to be handed over. Not the principle of handing over the interviews, but the number of interviews that were to be handed over. And Jack Dunn has dishonestly characterized that ever since as Boston College putting up a huge fight.
Well, let's hear that. If I can, Ed, I want to play what Jack said about that. We're talking to Ed Maloney, who was the director of BC's Belfast Project. Here is Dunn last week with us suggesting that BC did do everything it could do within the bounds of the law to protect the project. Listen to him.
We fought a vigorous defense over 2 years, and we won a significant court victory that protected some 75 to 80 interviews from being sent overseas. So Boston College did what it could legally. The criticism from Anthony McIntyre and project director Ed Maloney is that we didn't do enough. But I think it's a cultural divide, Marjorie. I think they don't understand, particularly Anthony McIntyre, who spent most of his life incarcerated in Northern Ireland. They don't have a respect for the legal system. We do. We engage the legal system. The legal system rendered a verdict. We had to accept that verdict. But we won a significant court victory. So the narrative that we didn't do enough is specious.
That was the voice of Jack Dunn. We spoke to him last week. He's the representative of Boston College. Ed Maloney's on the phone with us now. He's the director of the Boston College Belfast Project. Ed, it's obvious that Boston College has taken a huge public relations hit in this whole situation. So what I don't get is, what would be their motive? Why would they stonewall you like this? Why would they do what they did, you allege?
Well, you have to ask them that question. I cannot understand it for a moment. You know, I mean, one of the stories that I heard about the college president, Father Leahy, was that he had been a very strong critic of Cardinal Law over his handling of child sex allegations, pedophile allegations relating to the clergy in the Boston Diocese, and that he had said that Cardinal Law should have listened to his heart and not to his lawyers so much. Well, in this case, I think if Father Leahy had listened more to his heart and not to his lawyers, we would not be in the situation now. I think Father Leahy, if he had decided to fight this all the way, had mobilized all the resources that Boston College could have mobilized, all their alumni, all their political contacts, all their contacts throughout the rest of American academia, to make a real principled stand and fight as hard as you could all the way up to the Supreme Court to try to protect these interviewees who had taken a huge risk in giving Boston College a very valuable archive, historically valuable archive, and had been rewarded in this shameful fashion. I think now Father Leahy would be a hero amongst American academia. And instead, Boston College has been soiled by this affair, not least by their utter failure to stand up for the rights of people who participate in research projects. And this is an affair that's going to have enormously negative implications for American academic research generally. I mean, who in their right mind is now, who let's say is involved in a controversial episode in political life, is going to take part in a research project such as this, an oral history project such as the one that we ran at Boston College, in any American university, knowing that this is the way that you're likely to be treated at the end of the day?
Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen offered a theory that we did this because of the of Britain's help with us during the Iraq War, that they were our allies in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is there any credence to that, do you think?
I think there probably is. I mean, I think a lot of people were struck by the fact that when Gerry Adams was being questioned by the PSNI at Antrim Police Station about the kidnapping and abduction and murder of Jean McConville, Abu Hamza was appearing in a New York federal district court charged with Al-Qaeda-linked offenses, and he had been extradited from the United Kingdom at the request of the U.S. And I think you probably are seeing this working out. But it's an unthinking working out of this relationship, a quid pro quo relationship, because what the impact and the effect of the American decision to submit to these British requests is to undermine a peace process, which is one of the very few diplomatic triumphs for peacemaking and peaceful negotiation undertaken by the United States in the last 15 or 20 years. And it's having a very negative effect. I think we can see that in the way that attitudes are hardening in Northern Ireland. It's becoming almost impossible now to get agreement on dealing with the past, because a lot of unionists, hardline unionists, are rubbing their hands with glee and anticipation at the prospect of more dirt and prosecutions affecting the leadership of Sinn Féin, people who they are obliged to share power with and who they don't like sharing power with. And it's having this very, very negative effect. And that's only happening because the American government is going along with this. And whoever took these decisions in the Department of Justice just did not do minimum research into this. If they had spent 10 minutes on the internet researching the case of Jean McConville, they would have realized that the police who started this hunt for the Boston College Archives were fully aware that at the end of the day, the road that they were down would lead to the door of Gerry Adams, and that would have potentially calamitous consequences for the peace process. They must have known that, but why didn't the American government, why didn't the DOJ, why didn't Carmen Ortiz discover these things?
Ed Maloney, last question from me. Our first involvement with this topic on the radio was when we were talking to Tom O'Neill, son of Tip O'Neill, and Tom's deeply involved in Boston College. During that conversation, Anthony McIntyre, whose name we've mentioned, with whom you worked, and his wife Carrie Toomey called us from Northern Ireland during the discussion. And Carrie Toomey specifically said that they, as did many of the people with whom Kevin Cullen met when he was in Belfast a couple of weeks ago, that they really feared for their lives because of the release of these documents. Do you think those fears are well-founded?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind that the people who have been exposed as a result of these subpoenas are under a threat of death. I mean, it is the rule inside the IRA, and make no mistake, the IRA still exists as an organization. It is a rule inside the IRA that if you are caught betraying the organization's secrets, then you are liable to be killed under the justice system that the IRA upholds, and that's not something that one can take very, very lightly. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that, you know, someone's going to knock at Anthony McIntyre's door and put a bullet in his head, but he could be walking down the street one day when someone pushes him into the path of an oncoming car. That's the sort of danger that we're facing, as well as the direct danger and threat of violence. So, yes, I'm taking it very, very seriously indeed. And everyone who knows the situation in Northern Ireland knows how vindictive the leadership of this organization can be in these circumstances. Don't forget, these tapes have led to the arrest and embarrassment of one of their iconic leaders. You cannot treat these things lightly.
Ed, I said it was the last question. This one really is the last question. We only have a couple of seconds. Dunn, when he was here, said everybody shares some of the blame. BC, and I'm paraphrasing, BC made some mistakes too. Obviously, you think some is not the appropriate adjective there. Do you take any responsibility personally at all for the mess, any share of the mess that this thing has evolved into?
The thing I regret above all else was leaving research of the legal situation entirely to the Boston College end. I think that was a mistake because it left us open. We were too trusting. We took people's word. And the consequences of that is what we're living with now, I'm afraid.
Ed Maloney, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you for being with us. Ed Maloney was the director of the Boston College Belfast Project. Up next, why we all fall for the single item store, from the old-fashioned hot dog stand to the trendy storefronts that sell only cereal. Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to examine what happens when food comfort meets commerce. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, they're our children now, says Callie Crossley on the crush of children seeking safety in the U.S. If you missed it on the radio, check it out at WGBHnews.org right now.
This year's WGBH Boston Globe Summer Arts Weekend is great music for everyone, from everywhere, for free. July 26th and 27th in Boston's Copley Square, presented by Citizens Bank. More at bostonsummerarts.com.
Funding for our programs comes from you and State Street, partnering with institutional investors worldwide to create the way ahead. Proud to support Innovation Hub, Saturday at 10 a.m. and in the Innovation Block each Thursday at 9 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH. and Harvard Extension School, offering part-time master's programs in psychology, English, and international relations. Registration begins July 28th. More information available at extension.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last week, Crumbs, its cupcake franchise, filed for bankruptcy. The chain's 48 stores across 10 states, including, by the way, one at the Prue here, Federal Street, and one at the Natick Mall, or the Collection, or whatever it's called, closed last Monday, even though there are reports this morning that it may be rescued. Is this the danger of running a business that taps into a short-lived trend? Is this what happens when a franchise sells only one item? Is Crumbs a bankruptcy foretold for all the other food fads, like shops that sell only honey or a sandwich joint that serves only grilled cheese? What about the corner eatery that makes only rice pudding? Here with us for – I love rice pudding. Here with us for her – and grilled cheese. For her take on turning a trend into a business is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. She's the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey there.
So is this the problem, that Crumbs Bake Shop was just cupcakes? Is that the problem?
I don't think that's the primary problem here. I mean, almost every single business starts off as a one-product operation. You know, food businesses, computer businesses, China businesses, et cetera. So the question, I don't think, is about a single food product. Yes, certainly there are fads. Certainly there are trends. Certainly they ebb and then they – or they flow and then they ebb. But I think the issue with cupcakes is about – it sounds to me, and there's not a ton of public information out there, even though it's listed on the NASDAQ stock exchange, or it was until very recently. My sense is that the company, one, wasn't big enough when it went public 3 years ago. It didn't have the kind of momentum that you need in order to then take on the huge burden of being a public company, which involves all kinds of extra operations, disclosures, staff, you know, different kinds of targets for management to think about other than selling great cupcakes to more and more people. So I think going public with the kind of sales they had, somewhere around $12 million at that time, was way premature. It sounds like as well that in a sense they didn't build their base. So they didn't build their base either around cupcakes. Think about Starbucks selling coffee, which is basically what they sold for a long time,
yep.
Coffee and a few pastries. They managed to continue to build both their customer base as they opened stores, although it took some time. I mean, it was several years after Schultz bought the company in 87 before they went into the black. But they didn't, it seems to me that cupcakes didn't build their customer base sort of location by location. And it also seems like they didn't in some sense create something other than the cupcake, right? So, you know, you start off as a single product company, you still want in some sense to offer something to the person who walks in with their friend to buy a cupcake but may not want a cupcake. So, you know, I think there are probably a range of business issues here. Those two seem to me, the going public early and the lack of kind of build in the customer and customer base, both by location and by preference, seems to me to be glaring kind of issues in understanding this relatively short-lived company.
Can we stay on the single item thing?
Absolutely.
Because conceptually, I love the thing. I was telling Chelsea, our colleague, on Friday that when I lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, one of the many illegal rent control apartments I lived in New York City, there was a place that served only soup and salad, which is sort of a variation of theme. And it mm-hmm. did ultimately go out of business, but I loved it because you didn't have to think hard. It was mm-hmm. sort of – and I love the concept of this. Of course, there's the cronut somewhere mm-hmm. in yeah. – are there examples – you gave examples we'll talk about in a minute of the Howard Schultzes who started with a fad and then expanded at Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah. You could argue is the same sort
Absolutely.
Of thing. Is there any example – a local company, obviously.
Right.
Is there any example of a place that started – one product and essentially stayed one product and didn't expand dramatically that ultimately kept succeeding?
That's a really good question. I mean, you know, Dunkin's, it was a company founded, you know, I believe in – I want to say in the late 1930s. Don't quote me on that, but it's certainly no later than 1955. Now, for years and years and years, until Starbucks and the specialty coffee craze, you know, more than a craze, the specialty coffee shift, right, took America by storm and then settled in, if you will, to a permanent weather pattern. Before that, Dunkin' Donuts sold coffee and donuts and nothing else. They didn't, remember, they didn't have a lot of sandwiches.
Yeah.
They didn't have, you know, Munchkins were relatively late in their life story. So, I mean, that's a, and there are donut chains around the country that look like that. I came from a part of the country in the Midwest where Mr. Donut sold only coffee and about five kinds of donuts.
So why does that work? I mean, you're
well,
right. It did for a long time, at least. And by the way, and Chelsea just mentioned Baskin-Robbins for a long time
so
sold nothing except whatever number of flavors.
Whatever
and
31 yeah. it was, right? So that's, you know, so ice cream and coffee, let's start with the core products, or ice cream and coffee and donuts, particularly coffee, which is, and many people would say ice cream, which are have a kind of legally addictive quality
right.
to them, right? Give them some roots or, if you will, kind of teeth, right? Give them some stickiness. I think that's a piece of it. My mother used to say, darling, it's not ice cream or chocolate, it's medicine. So, you know, so that the idea that, you know, you got to have some ice cream now or you got to have a cup of coffee now, I think explains some of it. You know, I worked when I was a high school kid and I worked for a company called Famous Recipe Fried Chicken, which was a competitor to Kentucky Fried Chicken in the Midwest. And that company, which started in the 1960s, basically started with only mashed potatoes and fried chicken. It wasn't coleslaw, wasn't french fries, wasn't like, you know, chicken breaded chicken sandwiches, of course, are very popular fish and chips. Dish, you know, it didn't have all. There was no roast beef. Didn't have all that, and that company flourished, just offering a very kind of simplistic: come in and get your bucket of chicken, and your pint of mashed potatoes. So, you know, there are certain kinds of food products that grab an important niche and make and flourish, making a lot of money doing that. I think it's getting harder though because America's food tastes have expanded so much in the last 30 years. I remember when I first came to Boston, you walked into what was then Star Market on Sunday, and you know, which by the way wasn't open actually when I first got there, but you walk into Star Market and if you walked in the winter, there really was a very, very narrow selection of fresh produce that you could buy. Right? There was no ethnic section. There were no British chocolates. There were no, you know, kind of five different kinds of tortillas. There was nothing organic. And,
right.
And in 30 years, that has been completely transformed. And this is Boston. It's not Seattle or San Francisco
or
New York.
But that's still not as narrow as like Crumbs kind of thing. And I have to say, I know nothing about business. I think you've learned that in our relationship here. But I say to myself, I love the notion of a single item store. And it seems to me the way it might work is if it was situated physically near other stores that filled out. For example, if you have a grilled cheese-only joint or if you have a cupcake-only joint, but you're next door to a place that has coffee and whatever, why not?
Because I think the cupcake in some ways is a problem. I mean, everybody's on a diet. Everybody's worrying about their weight. The calories are 500 calories in a cupcake. You know, if you can go into Dunkin' Donuts, you don't have to have a donut. You can sit there and have a nice cup of coffee
But if it's really about America's, you know, thirst for wellness, I mean, it's hard to explain the success of Godiva, right, which wasn't an American company, but has just flourished. And they basically sell chocolate and chocolate and chocolate. So it's hard to explain that. It's hard to explain America's candy habits, which are, you know, just continue to be a very steadily growing, large per capita consumption and steadily, slowly growing. It's hard to explain that. We've always been bifurcated eaters, right? We've always, or certainly in the last 50 years, we have this, yes, we want to get healthy. Yes, we're all on a diet. And yes, we're willing to spend $4 and eat 1,000 calories. Some of the cupcakes at Crumbs. This is not so different from lots of different kinds of fast food. Had as many as 1,000 calories in them. So, you know, I don't know how you explain that schizophrenia, but it's been with us a long time.
But is part of it that you went in there and sat there? I mean, at least that was my vision of it from Sex and the City, when you went into the cupcake shop and you sat there. Actually, we have a nice
piece
of sound from their excursions at the Magnolia, I believe it was called, the coffee shop, a cupcake shop in New York City. Here it is.
Okay, now the tough question.
Should you sleep with them one last time?
Exactly. Going out of business sex, what do we think?
No.
Okay, quick draw. Give it a second here.
No.
Okay. That was a conversation, one of many conversations that took place in the Magnolia coffee shop in the great series Sex and the City. And they went in there and sat down.
Right. Right, and there are these great scenes of the characters, you know, eating these beautiful, colorful cupcakes. Magnolia Bakery is still around, right? They've got, I forget how many locations, you know, half a dozen or so in New York, and and perhaps some other places as well. And that was, I think, probably the springboard, right, for
yes.
the cupcake craze and the growth of Crumbs, which was founded by a husband and wife team in 2003 on the Upper West Side. So I think – and Magnolia's still in business, right? They're considered, you know, kind of New York operation, but they're still in business. And one of their flagship stores is right on – you know, right in the center of Midtown, right near Rockefeller Center. And I've been by it many, many times. It's packed. So I think part of it is, yes, you sit down just like – Starbucks and Pete's and McDonald's McCafes, right, are partly about sitting down and the experience of that. I think this is primarily an issue around business leadership and management in Crumb's case. That doesn't change Jim's point, Jim, that, you know, that single serve or single focus food shops have a very big appeal to consumers. You know, soup and salad places have flourished. Sandwich places continue to flourish. I read in the New Yorker article that there are stores that sell only oatmeal or only cereal, right? Or only rice pudding. And I think it is appealing to consumers because it suggests that something you love very much can be found in lots of different kind of shapes and forms, but that you can just go get that thing, to your
point.
You
don't have to do any thinking. And let me give you another example. Two words that I would suggest, considering I was going to use the word fad, and it is a fad, which generally means it's going to die out, but so far it hasn't. Food truck. One of the reasons why food trucks are such an explosion, beyond the fact they move around, which I sort of love, is you go to that food truck not because you're saying, I don't know what I feel like today.
Right.
The question is, what kind of grilled cheese am I going to get?
Yeah, exactly.
What kind of lobster roll am I going to get?
Or taco, right?
It has huge appeal to me. I don't even know why. When you mentioned you wanted to talk about this, I loved it. I've never been to Crumbs. But it's just sort of – I love the simplicity of knowing that there's only one thing.
Dave, you told me a million times about it. You went to a place, they served one meal every night. That was it.
Well, that was as a variational theme. Actually, also on the Upper West Side. I went there a lot. On West 72nd Street, and I can't think of the name of this place also close, which I guess is somewhat illustrative. They had only one entree every single night.
Uh-huh.
And I love that. And even if I wasn't crazy about the food. So, I mean, it's not quite the same thing because it changed every day. But that day, you could only have one thing and the place was packed every single day. So I guess where I'm going with this, and I think you know this, is I don't accept, even though I'm not a business historian at the Harvard Business School, I don't accept the notion that a single item thing can't work.
No,
I know the Harold Schultzes of the world have expanded it brilliantly, but I'm talking about just narrowly
just
doing
there.
Something.
I think you're onto something, Jim. And I think the underlying reasoning of what you're saying, if you describe your experience, is I don't want to be besieged and overwhelmed by choice. So you go into a restaurant like, you know, Cheesecake Factory, right?
Oh my!
And or you know, or something, you know, even you know, wonderful restaurants. I mean, Cheesecake Factory. I've never eaten there, but I've eaten in restaurants like even something like the 99 or a restaurant like not so much Bertucci's because they start off as pizza and now they have pasta and chicken. But
Friendly's has too much
but
stuff.
But Friendly's, and you start turning the pages.
Yes,
right. And there's like seven pages, right? And pretty soon you're overwhelmed.
Yeah.
You're just overwhelmed and. And it actually makes things kind of difficult. You start saying to someone next to you, what are you having? Let's have a meeting on our choices because it gets very complicated. So, yes, there's a lot to be said for I want a grilled cheese and here's grilled cheese. I think there's another thing that you said, though, is really important, and that is the very successful single-focus food retailers have had a real estate strategy. Everyone that wants to have multiple locations has to have a real estate strategy. And increasingly, that real estate strategy means who are you in the strip mall with? Who are you down the street with? Who is the landlord pairing you with that you agree to because the pairing itself makes sense for you? Starbucks has done this brilliantly. You know, I think Kentucky Fried Chicken did this very, very well. Taco Bell used to do this well when it was owned by PepsiCo. That is a really important piece of it.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Can I give you an example? Yeah. I've told you this before also, speaking of personal experience. I was in Chicago a few times in the last couple of years. I eat almost every meal unless I'm at an event at a place called Bao, B-A-O, which stands for bun. It's an Asian thing. Almost every meal. All they serve are Bao. And they're filled with all different kinds of things. Their breakfast Bao, their dessert Bao, There are bao that have traditional Asian kind of filling. But essentially, it's a bun. We discussed this with Lily Jan when she was here. It's essentially a Chinese dumpling with filling.
Yep.
And,
right.
But let me just say, every one of them was in next to a food court.
Yeah.
So if you went there and they didn't have the drink, they had a few drinks. They didn't have the drink you wanted or you wanted that to be part of a meal, you got your bao at the place that did bao but anybody else, and then you walked 30 feet and you had whatever had accompanied it.
So where is Starbucks next
for example,
they're not. They've diversified,
Well, they have diversified now, but in years past, they wanted to be near certain bagel retailers, or they now want to be near Evolution Fresh, which is a juice company. That they own, right? So the idea that you put, your location, whether you're franchised or company owned, you put your location next to or in the vicinity of something that's all equally appealing. And the play there is twofold. One, if it's coffee and juice, maybe you're going after the same customer, right? But if it's the food court and bao, you're going for two people or three people where there's some divergence of choice, but everyone ends up with what they want, and they end up, and this is the key thing with all kinds of food retailing and all retailing generally, in your neighborhood and in your store. So I think that is something that we don't see here. We get nothing in the public reports about attention to real estate location and what else you eat when you eat cupcakes.
We're talking to Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School about the Crumbs Bake Shop kind of hanging by a thread. It had been shutting down all its stores. Now they may be getting a loan to keep them going for a while. There was in one of these stories, it talked about TCBY, that yogurt joint. Used to be 1,413 stores. Now we're down to 355. So what was their problem?
Yeah, I mean, and Krispy Kreme has remnants of
Krispy
this too,
Kreme,
right? Because they are way, way, way down, right? So what, those stories, just like Crumbs, are about a couple of things. But one of the things is, is the novelty of any kind of offering that fades if there isn't what we were just talking about, kind of a rooted consumer desire, or if a trend doesn't become a habit and a preference. So I think that's a piece of it. But in Krispy Kreme, in the yogurt company, in some of these other companies, no question there was also just poor managerial decision-making, right? About, if you remember Krispy Kreme, there was a whole kind of set of questions about how they were managing their finances, right? And whether that was really about franchise fees versus store sales, selling high and buying low, or or gross margin and then net margin. So each of these stories isn't just about, we hit the bullseye, but it was only a temporary taste. It's also about how you roll out, right, an idea, build a customer base, manage multiple locations, hire people, and figure out how to grow and maintain the oxygen that is your current business. Those are really difficult things. Very, very few businesses of any kind, particularly in food, get past their first year. So I think a lot of what we're seeing here is a high profile, media obsessed or media friendly brand that ran into bread and butter business operational and financial problems.
Yeah, and also I think that the point that Marjorie made and you made about high calorie, I mean, it fit a time. Someone wrote a piece, I think it was in the New Yorker, which is a little a feat for me, this particular article.
Little twee, wasn't it?
It fit the time, that we were looking for comfort and childlike simplicity after 9/11. I mean, maybe there's some truth in that, but certain things just don't have staying power beyond the fact that they're single. The Krispy Kreme experience, the reason I was smiling when you were mentioning this, Marjorie and I were on commercial radio at the time. When Krispy Kreme was announced to be coming, we did a show, and I say, other than the show we did about Wegmans coming to New England, we had callers who generally only called about heavy political things. It was do you remember those phone calls? I went to one in the South. And then they opened one store in Medford. I went there the first day, if you recall, Marjorie.
Was there a line?
I'd say the line was 500 to 1,000 people.
Wow. Ridiculous.
I didn't get one the first day. And it was on Route 16, I think, in Medford. But however, the gimmick they had that I said to Marjorie the next day, I didn't get in. It's going to make zillions of dollars. I got to figure out how to invest. Of course, I don't know how to invest, so I didn't, thankfully. Is I said, the light goes off when they come out of the oven, so when they're fresh. and it's like you salivated.
Right.
But, you know,
but that was the problem. When they weren't right out of the oven, they were just kind of like ho-hum
yeah,
donuts.
Yeah, is that all there
so
is?
So you had to, like, put them in the microwave, and it was we were very disappointed about the whole thing. But the other thing, just one last thing about businesses. You know, I just happened to be somewhere the other night where somebody was talking about this guy that owned, like, 50 Dunkin' Donut franchises in my hometown right around Fall River. And the guy's loaded.
Yeah.
So you can really do astronomically well. And but there's a great deal of difference between one franchise's business and another franchise's business based on location and stuff.
Absolutely. So the way that companies like Dunkin' Donuts, McDonald's, Coke bottlers used to work something like this when back in the days when Coke had franchised its bottling operations out. The way that the basic kind of, if you will, railroad tracks of running this kind of business, if you're a franchisee like your gentleman, right, he buys the franchise from Dunkin' Donuts to open up X number of stores. He probably not only pays an annual franchise fee and upfront costs for the right to take the Dunkin' Donuts name, he may also have to buy X number of supplies and dough and then coffee from Dunkin' Donuts. So Dunkin' Donuts' parent corporation makes a lot of money out of franchising, some of it upfront. But then he is left, in a sense, this was Ray Kroc's brilliant insight in founding the McDonald's franchise in the 50s. He is left as his own business owner in some very, very real sense. He gets to, let's say, have a franchise. He gets franchises for 8 stores. He gets to, you know, with some company guidelines that he has to adhere to, you know, go to certain locations. He may pay rent to the company on part of those locations. He gets to hire a staff. He gets to decide how clean the stores will be, again, within parent company guidelines. And he gets to be his own – he is an entrepreneur. So some of the richest people in this country are people that are Dunkin' Donuts franchisees, McDonald's franchisees. I remember speaking at a young president's organization event many years ago, and I met a husband and wife team, and they were worth well over $100 million, and they had done it on McDonald's stores, right, a whole big cluster of them in and around Chicago, right, all the way stretched down into the middle of Illinois. And they, you know, these are the kind of people that can make that kind of money, you know, and run that kind of success year over year, because they didn't make that money. That Dunkin' Donuts franchisee didn't make that money in a year. He made it over a decade or more, because you gotta open up the shop on time. The coffee's got to be hot. The donuts have to be more than a little red light going off or on, right? It has to work over and over again, when the average transaction, think about it, is no more than probably $4, maybe more now because, you know, they charge Starbucks prices for coffee. But in general, it is about, you know, literally making the donuts every day in a clean, well-lit, right, nicely smelling, efficient operation. And that is really hard. So, you know, all the power to him for figuring out how to do that, not over one location, but over maybe a dozen.
Yeah.
Nancy, I want you to know, if you're looking at Marjorie smiling and you're saying she must like what I'm saying, I don't want to break your burst your ball. It's nothing to do with you. It's because she's thinking of eating a donut. I know. Is that a fair?
Well, I do like donuts. I mean, who doesn't like donuts?
Yeah, I think that's a piece of this story, though. Can I just to kind of cut to the chase about someone who once taught food retailing? Cupcakes, donuts, rice pudding, hot soup. These are all foods that we can all identify with, that we have all, at one moment or another, probably many, many moments, had an unequivocally good experience with, because it tastes good. No, seriously.
No, you're right.
It tastes good, and we know exactly what it feels like to want that hot cup of coffee and that, you know, powdered sugar donut, right, at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I think and Crumbs is a great name. I mean, again,
great name.
The idea of this wasn't crazy, but it is all about execution. You know, day in and day out, transaction.
By the way,
transaction.
Can I tell you something? When you talk about a 1,000-calorie cupcake, execution is the right word. Nancy Kane, thanks. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Nancy. Nancy Kane is the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, great to talk to you. Okay, up next, we're going to take your calls on this. Do you fall for these single-item stores? Does the notion of a place that only serves toast or oatmeal or ice cream appeal to you? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Talk talking the talk or keeping the faith.
We got Obama, and it's wonderful, but it is not going to address the structural problems that exist in the black community, which he has done practically nothing.
Symbolism versus action in President Obama's approach to race. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you and UMass Lowell, offering part-time graduate and undergraduate degrees online or on campus. Fall classes start September 3rd at UMass Lowell. You can learn more at continuinged.uml.edu. And Xfinity on the X1 Entertainment Operating System. Xfinity brings TV and internet together so you can access all of your entertainment in one place. More information available online at comcast.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You know, we were just talking with Harvard historian Nancy Kane about the single item store and why, even though they're usually riding a food fad, they endure or don't. You just heard her say, we love the idea of going into a place that serves up something reliable. I don't know, hot bowl of soup, chocolate chip cookies, scoop of ice cream. By the way, I love it. I love single item stores. Our questions to you are manifold. One, what's your favorite single item store? It doesn't have to be food. There could be a record store, a lamp store, whatever. Two, if you could create a single item store from scratch, what would you sell or serve? I want to ask Marjorie that in a minute. Three, can you recall a single item store that isn't around anymore? One that you love, one that you missed. And four, what's the most ridiculous single item store you've ever seen? Our number is 877-301-8970. Let me ask you the second question. If you could create, Marjorie, a single item store from scratch,
yep,
you get the financing, what is it? I'm dying to hear this. What would you sell?
Well, Nancy Kane was talking about rice pudding.
Yeah.
I would go for the bread pudding with the white chocolate and the caramel sauce. Ty English used to have at this place, you know, this pizza joint. I think he still does, one of those pizza joints.
Yeah.
And you could get that for dessert.
Yeah. What was that again?
Bread pudding. Bread pudding with white chocolate and caramel sauce.
Let me tell you something. If a store that only sold bread pudding with white chocolate caramel sauce opened on a Friday, if it made it to Monday, yeah, that would be considered
a huge
success. Have you ever had
the Todd English bread pudding with white caramel, with white chocolate and caramel sauce? Well, I think you should wait until you reserve judgment until you've had it.
877-301-8970. I mean, by the way, I thought since
what's yours?
We talked to Nancy, I would do with that store from and a couple of them sadly are opening because I should have opened them here. Wow Bao was the name of the place in Chicago. All they sell are Asian buns. It is
unbelievable.
Someone suggested I should call it Browdy's Buns, which is an idea.
They're legendary.
Exactly. Thank you. And but that's what I would open here. And by the way, there's one about to open in Cambridge. I don't know. And there are some dumpling
buns?
Houses.
What do you mean buns? Dumplings?
Dumplings are little buns, little dough covered. We discussed this with Lily Jen.
Kind dough of covered things.
All different kinds of. And by the way, don't call and say there's already a dumpling house in Cambridge and the great dumpling house in Chinatown. I know it is, but they serve everything. It's a full restaurant. Dumplings at the core. I mean dumplings only. That has a huge allure to me.
Yeah. And the grilled cheese. Thing. They do have the Roxy truck is a grilled cheese. But
do you remember when they came to GBH a couple of months ago?
It was great. And they had all these varieties of grilled cheese, different kinds of breads, different kinds of fillings. You do grilled cheese, tomato, grilled cheese. You ever had grilled cheese and avocado?
No.
It's pretty good.
You know what's also great about a grilled cheese? And then we'll get to the calls at 877-301-8970. Every time I've ever had a grilled cheese in my life, this is true.
Uh-huh.
You take a bite. It is so greasy. Do you not feel it come out of your pores? We have to ask the curiosity desk about this, Edgar B. Herwig III. How does that happen? You have one bite of a grilled cheese, and every pore is exuding the grease from the sandwich you just took a bite of.
You know what I used to make when I was a kid?
No, I don't.
Grilled cheese cheeseburgers.
Oh, man.
And you'd squish the bread. They used to have something like that at Friendly's, like the big beef cheeseburger special where they like
– on toast.
It would be on toast and instead of a bun, and it would be grilled cheese bread, like you smash it down on all the butter on the grill, and then you had the grilled cheese smashed into the cheeseburger.
That's living,
Marjorie. It was great. It was probably, you know, not good for your arteries, I would guess. But boy, did it taste great.
So let's take a couple of calls here at 877-301-8970. What's your favorite single item store? If it doesn't exist, what's the single item that you'd sell in such a store? Let's take John. You're in Bristol, Rhode Island. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, John.
Yes, my favorite single item restaurant. Pizzeria Regina in the North End, the original. Since 1926, has been selling pizza, pizza, and pizza. If you want a salad, you go somewhere else. If you want soup, you go somewhere else. It's pizza, pizza, and pizza, and every time I've gone there, and I've been going there since the 50s, you have to wait in line.
You do. And there's no place to park. You have to park about, you know, 9 miles away. No,
what'd you say, 1926, John?
Yeah, it's great. Why is it, John?
1926, I just checked it.
That's great.
Why have they been unable to replicate? I guess it's the ovens, because lots of places sell Regina's pizza. We've been to places that sell Regina's pizza around here. Yeah. Doesn't taste the same. It's the oven problem, correct?
I think the original North End Thatcher Street, 11 and a half Thatcher Street, it's so popular, they had to put heaters outside on the sidewalk to keep people warm.
John, you sound like a happy man talking about it. John, thanks for the call.
Even
though it's not a single item, why is it that the Carnegie Delicatessen, arguably the greatest delicatessen in the world, and then Stage, didn't Stage open in the Theater District? Stage Delicatessen is a great one in New York City, too. They opened in the Theater District. It was a big nothing. They couldn't replicate, I don't know why, what they did there. By the way,
that's right.
I would tell you right now, if they had a store that, forget a big Jewish deli, which the city is missing, corned beef and pastrami, and that's it. That's all they sold. You don't think that would make it? Let me tell you something. I alone would keep it in business. Hannah, you're in Wellesley. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Hannah.
Good. How are you?
Great. Thank you for the call.
I was going to say that I was in New York City recently, and there's a lot of those single-focused shops there, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was visiting my daughter, and we were on a production shoot for a web TV show, and they went and got takeout, and it was all meatballs.
And it was delicious.
And there were every conceivable kind. And the only sides they had were things like, I think they had a salad and some couscous and some macaroni and cheese. So there were a few things to go with it, but mostly it was all meatballs all the time.
Oh, Jim, you better get down there right away.
How great
And I think it might have just been called meatballs. I'm not sure.
You know, you know what that made me think of? I had forgotten years and years ago. I was on the Bowery in New York City, and I went to a place that's the most famous pickle place in the world, which I can't think of the name of it. I'll think of it in a minute. And when you finally find it on the Bowery, it's three huge barrels out on the street in front of the storefront, and that's all they serve. Sort of Grillo's Pickles, by the way. There's one in Inman Square. That's all they serve are pickles.
Pickles is just
it's great.
Hannah, do they have bread, though? I mean, suppose you want to do like the meat, you know, sop up the...
BYOB.
I didn't do the takeout. It was just lovely, nicely appeared before me, but they probably do. But the other thing I wanted to say was this is a throwback to a different time and a different quality of life where there were single-focused stores. You'd go to your butcher, you'd go to your bakery, you'd go to your fishmonger.
Great point.
And it was probably a better quality of life in some ways than we have now.
Hannah, that was a great call. Thank you. Now, Marjorie.
There are some standalone bakeries, because I spend a lot of time at standalone bakeries.
But I think that's too broad. I mean, a single-item store is like the Cronuts place in New York City that has made the croissant donut thing. Now, let me ask you something. If it turns out within 3 miles of our studio here, over here in Brighton, there was a meatballs-only store, and we get out of here at 1:57. How many minutes would it take you to be at the meatball store?
No.
Like 8?
You know, every time we talk about food,
I know.
The same thing. Why didn't we bring like something to eat? I'm like getting famished thinking about meatballs.
Can I tell you what Hannah said?
And the Parmesan, grated Parmesan cheese on top.
As I said, BYOB, bring your own bread. Tell me for a second.
What?
I thought what Hannah said at the end was perfect. Wasn't that a better time? I mean, now you have a store. You go to a Target or something. They have food. They have clothing.
Jim,
it's ridiculous.
Why don't you tell us about your many Paris, many springtimes in Paris when you've gone from the patisserie to the wine store and then you're over there.
I don't go to the
cafes.
Wine store. I sit at the cafes for hours and hours and people watch. But the cafes serve everything. I only get one thing, which is cafe au lait or something like that. But I don't know why I feel this way, but it just maybe it's because of what Hannah said. It was a better time. I don't know if it was a better time. It was a better way of selling things. The notion that somebody develops a colossal expertise in one particular item, whatever it is just, it's great to me.
I think the problem is there's no place to park.
You know what's a good example? Not a bakery. I'll give you an example.
What?
We both shop there, too, just at different ones. What's the name of the bread company we both like?
Pigs Fly.
When Pigs Fly.
Pigs Fly.
All they sell is bread.
They do.
Nothing else. A lot of different bread.
They also sell Pigs Fly aprons, and I bought one.
Can I ask you also?
I want to have it right across, you know, when I'm cooking in the kitchen.
The When Pigs Fly that you go to. I go to the one in Somerville. Where's yours? In Brookline?
Brookline. Beacon Street.
You're surrounded physically when you walk in by bread, right?
God.
In every direction.
Yes.
How great is that?
That's
what I'm talking about.
It's absolutely great.
Okay.
I think they sell fish there one day a week, which seems rather incongruous.
I hope not.
Let's go to Margo in Gardner. What do you think, Margo?
Hey, Margo.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I actually called to say how ridiculous I think that the concept is.
Why?
I'm going to adapt it a little bit after the last caller, because I live in a very small town in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And recently a store opened that only sells oil and vinegar. And it just seems so ridiculous to me. I mean, it can barely, you know, the local population can barely support, you know, the small grocery store in the center of town. And then the
Margo, we've got a bad connection, but I think Margo said a store.
Only oil and vinegar.
Well, who's going to go to a store?
Well, you know what the good news for Margo?
Oil and vinegar. How can you get passionate about oil and vinegar?
Well, also, I think the good news for Margo is the store is going to be gone in a couple of days, so she doesn't have to worry about it. Margo, we didn't cut you off because we didn't like what you said. It was just a horrible
connection.
It was a right. You know what I just realized? You know what also exists in Harvard Square? I'm not a big honey person.
Oh, I love honey.
There is a honey only store right outside Harvard Square on Mass Ave. Yeah, all they sell is helly. It's is honey. It's a basement store. And by the way, even if you don't like honey that much, which I do not, you're surrounded by it in all of its incarnations.
That could
it's
be
really
iffy.
Beautiful.
I love honey, but that seems a little iffy.
What do you mean iffy?
Well,
I think it's been there for quite a while.
Something a little bit more substantial than just honey.
You know what they're thinking of adding?
What?
Oil and vinegar. Let's go to John and Dedham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about single item stores. John, hi there.
Jim and Marjorie, how are you today?
We're
fine,
excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Oh, this is Sean from Denver. Hey, Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Yeah, how quickly you forget things.
Believe me, I chose to, Sean. Go ahead.
Marjorie, how's your summer going?
Great, Sean. How's
okay,
yours?
Sean,
good?
Go ahead.
Excellent. How's your love life, Marjorie?
Terrific.
Okay, go ahead, Sean.
I've got a brother who might be looking, so.
Fine.
Okay.
I'll send him your way.
Good, thank you.
Now, Jimmy, I'm bothered by Victoria's Secret. Jimmy, how many songs can a lady actually own? I mean, they portray women as sex objects. I mean, come on. I walk in there, these scantily clad people.
Oh,
I'm thinking, I have to go in and do my research. But I just can't believe what they do. And all they do is sell one thing. They're a one-trick pony.
Oh, John, your brother just called. He wants you to call him right away. Sean, thank you for sharing your perspective with
I think they have lingerie and nightgowns as well in Victoria's Secret.
It's not a one-item store.
No,
877-301-8897. By the way, I was totally serious about what I said before about opening a bow store. I just never got around to it because I'm relatively busy.
I know.
Would you not go there?
When I first met you, you were going to sheet wrap
cars.
All the
that
cars.
Was good. That's another business
idea. That worked out well.
Shrink wrap, not sheet wrap. If I had sheet wrapped them, it wouldn't have been a success.
Oh, did you shrink wrap?
Shrink wrap. No, I didn't do it. I was going to do it.
What did I say?
Shrink wrap. Shirt wrap.
Oh,
or whatever.
Whatever.
Hey, Julianne, you're in Fall River, hometown of Marjorie Egan. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, it's Julia.
Hi, Julia.
Hi,
sorry.
Hi, Julia.
It's okay. Noodles and Company. They basically do all kinds of noodles, like whether you're getting Asian pad thai or whether you're getting meatballs and marinara.
Ooh.
Or mac and cheese.
Where's that?
I didn't think there was any in the area, but I was just looking it up while I pulled over waiting for the call to go through, and there's one in Burlington, and there's one in Shrewsbury, and one coming to Nashua. But I found out about this in Indianapolis when I was there for a convention. There was a noodle company that basically they were like lines out the door from convention goers trying to go get some noodles.
Now, Julianne, is it what attracted you, just the noodle, because you're into noodles, or because you, like me, love the idea of a single item store in an area that makes you happy, like noodles? What draws you?
I like the idea that you can get the one thing, the noodle, in a variety of different ways at this one place.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to the Italian place to get the Italian, you know, meatballs, marinara, whatever. You can just go to the noodle company. If you're feeling like you want to get the, you know, meatballs, you can get the mac and cheese, which is really good, by the way.
Hey, Julia, thank you very much for the call. It sounds wildly appealing. And speaking of noodles, I think we have another noodle caller on the phone. Richard, you're in Hyde Park. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Richard. Oops. Richard, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
We only have a minute, Richard. Shoot.
Somebody was mentioning noodles, and Yumeo Katare, which has been open for about half a year now. They only serve one dish, which is a noodle dish. They have regular and large.
That's a ramen dish, right?
Yeah.
But by the way, the only problem with that place, if I'm thinking of the right place, when you drive by, the lines, I don't care when, from 5 o'clock on when it opens, are usually around the block, right?
Yes, about an hour and a half.
Oh my God! What's it called again, Richard?
Yumeo Katare.
Yeah, it's a ramen place right outside the Porter Square Mall, and everybody, including my kids who've been there, said it's as good as anything they've ever had. I think we're on to something, Marjorie. We've got to find a product, and believe me, it is not bread pudding with white caramel sauce.
How about baked potatoes?
No, it's bao. Browdy's buns. I'm telling you, it can be huge. Oh, they are. Well, whatever. Let's move on. Forget that.
Okay. Up next, we are going to talk with our TV guru. We're going to talk with Bob Thompson. He's going to tell us about the Emmys. He's also going to tell us about Seinfeld, the 20th anniversary of Seinfeld, and how all these years later, Seinfeld still reverberates through TV and through our culture. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
WGBH sustainer Deborah from Winthrop, Massachusetts.
The reason I donate to WGBH is because I feel like it's a really good use of my time to be able to become informed of current events in so many different areas of life. And I'm an auditory learner, so I prefer to hear my news. WGBH is such a valuable resource for me. I just get so much good information from it.
Show your support at WGBHnews.org.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and Blue Man Group at the Charles Playhouse, proud to sponsor the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend. Blue Man Group, presenting their first Boston Drum Off. More information available at blueman.com/Boston Drum Off. And Pure Solutions, featuring Pure's organic tick and mosquito solutions. You can keep mosquitoes and ticks away from your upcoming outdoor wedding or event without the use of harmful pesticides. More information at puresolutions.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Festivus, Vandalay Industries, the Soup Nazi, just a micro fraction of the cultural references that Seinfeld gave the world 25 years ago. This month, it made its TV debut and remains, even in this golden era of TV, a cultural touchstone. Joining us to talk about Seinfeld and how it's never really left us is Bob Thompson. Bob is the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello there, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
We're great. Great to talk to you, Bob, as always. So is it still kind of reverberating back into 2014 after 25 years, the whole show Seinfeld? What do you think?
I think it really is, especially if you're of a certain age that you watch this, and that pretty much meant everybody that was conscious up until 1998. And Melissa McCarthy got interviewed by CNN. She was doing the Tammy opening or whatever, and they asked her about this, and I think she made a really, really good point. She said, you know, practically no experience that you have doesn't lend itself at some point to saying, oh, remember that Seinfeld episode when this happened? And I have to say, that's really true. I remember not long ago, I get my haircut at the same place all the time, and I was out of town and I needed a haircut, and I got one, and I felt this sense of that I had committed adultery, that I was being unfaithful. And immediately, I thought of that Seinfeld episode, which took that little slice of American psychosis and beautifully weaved this little Baroque funny story about it. And they did that with so many things. You named a bunch a minute ago, you know, standing in line waiting for a table at a restaurant, losing your car in a parking garage, and on and on and on and on and on. They really nailed it. And that was because it so much was not a show about nothing. It was a show about very small little things, which they turned into the stuff of epic tragedy.
You know, Bob, you mentioned a minute ago to Marjorie that yeah, it's still huge. But I'm interested in the demographic. Marjorie and I, years ago, with some sponsors at our former job, went to a Simon and Garfunkel reunion. We were the youngest people there by far. Do kids watch Seinfeld now, or do they not? Or is it still people reminiscing about what was 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago?
Well, I can tell you about my students, which is not exactly a scientific sample, but they still very much know Seinfeld, and when you make a reference to Seinfeld episodes, they understand what you're talking about, which, by the way, is not true of previous classics. If I make a Vitamina Vegemin reference in class, I get nothing but blank stares. That was, of course, from I Love Lucy. If I make a Oh, Mr. Grant reference from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, I get nothing. At the same time, if I say Master of Your Domain, they immediately know what I'm talking about. I'm not sure how long that's going to be. I mean, this stuff is, to this day, it's available on DVDs, on various online sites. It's rerun constantly in most markets. So there's certainly a lot of opportunities to see it. There's a lot of opportunities to see other stuff as well. We all knew The Andy Griffith Show, even though it was older than we were as kids, because there was nothing else to watch when we got home from school. That's not the case anymore for kids.
We're talking with our TV guru, Bob Thompson. You know, Jim is obsessed vis-a-vis Seinfeld, maybe with the show, but more with this interview Jerry Seinfeld gave to Larry King right after Seinfeld ended. Let's hear a piece of that.
You gave it up, right?
I did.
They didn't cancel you. You canceled them.
You're not aware of this?
No, I'm asking you.
You think I got canceled? Are you under the impression that I got canceled?
Have I hurt you, Jerry?
I thought that was pretty well documented. Is this still CNN? I was the number one show on television, Larry.
You were all...
Do you know who I am?
Jewish guy, Brooklyn.
Yes.
Okay.
75 million viewers last episode.
What? Don't take it so bad.
Well, that's the big difference between being canceled and being number one.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You know, Seinfeld seemed legitimately angry in that one of the great Larry King interviews of all time, no?
Well, it was a Larry King classic. That definitely goes in Larry King's clip file. But I don't know. I'm a big fan of Jerry Seinfeld. I think his show is one of the classic American shows of all time. But I think there he was just being a bully. I mean, we all know by the time that interview happened, everybody knew that Larry King didn't prepare for interviews. Larry King used to brag about the fact that he didn't prepare for interviews. By this time in his career, this was Larry King's thing. You know, he couldn't spell Lady Gaga, I think. But anyway, so for Jerry to go off on this, say it ain't so, Larry, you know, you don't know what you're asking me about. But if that had been Brokaw interviewing him, I could see he could get indignant. But this was Larry King. I think he was a little sanctimonious there, if you ask me.
You know what is one of the strangest things about this show, though? You don't see Jerry Seinfeld anymore. I mean, usually when you have this phenomenal success, as he pointed out, number one show, 75 million listeners tuning in for the last episode, and then he just basically disappeared.
Well, there was the B-movie.
That was horrible. Horrible.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think to some extent, Jerry Seinfeld realized, and I don't, far be it from me to try to get into his head, but I think he realized that he had achieved something, that there was no possible way that he could ever, exceed. And I think he did, you're right, he was not quite to the extent that Carson, when Carson retired, he really disappeared.
Yeah. Right.
Jerry pops up here and there, but he does it on very modest sorts of scales. He did the semi-reunion on Curb Your Enthusiasm. He does what can be really brilliant at times, that people in cars getting coffee or whatever.
Oh, yes. That's...
Internet thing. And some of those are like seminars, stand-up comedy.
Well, you know, speaking of that, as Marjorie and you were talking about that, Bob Thompson, I'm thinking, other than Larry David, obviously the creator, writer, et cetera, one of the key people, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who obviously is brilliant, in my opinion, in Veep, nobody else has done anything other than episodically, have they?
Well, Michael Richards tried his own show. That lasted practically, that was gone by the
Kramer,
half
yeah.
season. And then, of course, he got caught on a cell phone with that horrendous racist tyrant at an L.A. comedy club. So his career really became compromised. George's, the actor that played George, of course.
Jason Alexander, yeah.
Jason Alexander had a few attempts at series that also didn't go very far.
He just sang with the Boston Pops, by the way. I didn't know he was had he done Broadway or something? Keith Lockhart told us recently from the Boston Pops that Jason Alexander sang with him a couple of months ago.
I think he had done that. I knew him best before Seinfeld as one of the people who did Rolled Gold pretzel commercials.
Oh, really?
Well, he had a full head of hair back then, too.
We're talking...
That guy could eat pretzels like you would not believe. Never seen anybody do it better.
That's beautiful. Brings back great memories.
We're talking to Bob Thompson from our TV guru from Syracuse University. So much of America has been in mourning since Breaking Bad went to bed, as it were, no more. But now we learn that we have a new Breaking Bad in Spanish. Please tell us about it, Bob Thompson.
They take the scripts. It's pretty much a scene-by-scene remake. With a couple of significant changes. It takes place in Bogota as opposed to Albuquerque, but pretty much straight, but it's completely redone. So they have actors, and it's different actors, and it's in Spanish. And it looks surprisingly good, and if you know Breaking Bad really well, you don't really need to know Spanish because, you know, you've seen it all before. So it's actually kind of fun to watch, and the title was changed to, and this is actually even a better title if we did it in English. The English title would be Metastasis.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what Breaking Bad is. When a tumor metastasizes, it breaks bad and starts doing all kinds of things it shouldn't do. But if I had to sum up Walter White in one word, metastasized would not be a bad word for it.
Well, first of all,
Bob. Walter Blanco.
Why, Walter Blanco, course, and Jesse...
And the bad thing about that is it takes away all that Walt Whitman reference. I mean, Walter White used to be an abbreviated form of Walt Whitman, and Whitman, of course, plays a major role in that show.
Well, and also Jesse Pinkman is Jose Miguel.
Right.
And here's a little piece of it for those who haven't caught the flavor of these, of Metastases.
Dos libras semanalmente, cada una $35,000. Son 70 millones para cada uno.
¿Dos libras?
Sí.
Usted sabe lo que ese man nos hace donde nosotros no le cumplamos con dos libras.
A ver, es cuestión de organizarse, es cuestión de apretar los horarios de trabajo.
A mí los horarios me valen.
You know, let me tell you, Bob, I don't speak a word of Spanish. I am so there. It doesn't make any difference. Has anybody ever done this? We know, especially with American movies, there's lots of dubbing, which is as horrible as it gets. Has anybody taken an American television series and just essentially totally converted it into their language and their culture?
Yes, I believe they have, and we've done it a lot. Remember Three's Company way back in the day? The first season of Three's Company is almost identical. They just took the scripts and they reset it in Venice, California, or Santa Monica, or wherever that is. And but if you go back and you watch the British ones, which was called Man About the House, they're the same scripts redone. We did it to Coupling not long ago, to much less success than Three's Company. So that is, we've done it, I think, more often than it's been done with U.S. things. But I'm pretty certain it's been done on many occasions. This happens to be, though, I think, a really expert. For one thing, the actor playing Walter Blanco really evokes Bryan Cranston. I mean, he really looks like it. Jose Miguel is actually a little more traditionally attractive, I think, than Pinkman, and that's may not be a good thing. But anyway, it really looks like it's been done with a good deal of expertise.
Let me ask you just a really dumb question about this, Bob Thompson. You know, in some ways I don't get it. You know, why not just do the American version in Colombia instead of making a whole new version?
Because dubbing is horrible.
Is that?
I don't know.
We don't have to do dubbing. You could do subtitles.
Is that
you?
Or subtitles? What
I mean,
is the
I just
answer?
Wonder why. You know what I mean? If you have, what's in it for the people that are going to see this new one as opposed to just a remake of the old one?
Well, I mean, the purest form to experience this, no matter where you are, would be to watch the original, either dubbed or in subtitles. But we all know that dubbing constantly takes you away from the show because you're being bothered by the lack of synchronization, the voices and the whatever. And secondly, you can never get a dub voice to perfectly fit the actor that's playing it. You've got a different human being speaking than the human being that's on the screen. And subtitles means, you know, you've got to read. And when you're watching TV, who wants to be reading? So that's one of the reasons you're watching television. So I think the idea of taking a show like this that did have so much going for it and letting an entire population of Spanish-speaking people, which is an enormous number of people, experience it without the distancing that comes from translation through either of those forms is actually not a bad idea. I'm not sure how I would feel about it if I was the one that made the original. But I think with a show like this, it's a great idea. And as one critic pointed out, it gives us all the chance to see the show, what did she say, for the very first time, a second time.
That's a great line. I love that. You know, speaking of Breaking Bad, we're speaking to Bob Thompson from Syracuse. Breaking Bad, Fargo, True Detective, Orange is the New Black, House of Cards, some of our favorites, which we've discussed with you, are amongst the big-time nominees for the Emmys. Here's a little bit of sound from all of them.
You clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger.
If you don't stand up to the boss, the wife,
loser,
you're just gonna get washed away.
Scrunion?
I didn't do nothing.
Death created time to grow the things that it would kill.
I have a wife. What? A prison wife. Her name is Crazy Eyes, and she follows me everywhere.
One heartbeat away from the presidency, not a single vote cast in my name. Democracy is so overrated.
Those are five of the best bites I've ever heard from any television
the
shows.
Oh, my God.
So the Emmys this year, I mean, how do you sum them up in a sentence or two? The nominations are obviously out a week, Bob Thompson.
Well, I mean, I suppose the one thing, when these nominations come out, and this is true the last couple of years, it reminds us how much extraordinarily good television there is out there. I mean, every single one of these things on the list, if we would have shown it in 1979, would have been the greatest thing that had ever appeared on TV by a far cry from whatever was in second place. Both the comedies and the dramas and the miniseries. I mean, there's just so much good television. One of the other things about these nominations, though, is how the very definitions of what constitutes the old categories has been breaking down for a long time, and it's finally beginning to show here. We've got Orange is the New Black in the comedy category, which I think was cynically nominated there so they wouldn't have to compete with that incredible list up in drama. And then you've got, and I may have this reversed, but I think Fargo is in miniseries, but True Detective is in drama. And essentially, both Fargo and True Detective are the same animal. They're short-run programs that get renewed with entirely new casts. So whether that's a drama or a miniseries, they're the same, but they're in two different categories. So, you know, the merging of comedy and drama has been happening since, back in the early 1980s. But in many ways, these categories are still reflecting a period that television has really grown away from.
Let me be in full swoon and just read the nominees for Best Actors in a Drama. This list, Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson from True Detective, Bryan Cranston for Breaking Bad, Jeff Daniels for Newsroom, Kevin Spacey for House of Cards, and Jon Hamm for Mad Men. I mean, six of the great... I mean, it's just, I almost can't speak, Bob Thompson. It's incredible.
It is. I mean, it's just that is an amazing list. And there are a lot of other people that are acting and currently running television shows who aren't even on that list. Buscemi, for example, from Boardwalk Empire. And that list goes on and on. It is a breathtaking list. And for all that, and this may be blasphemy, I don't know how you guys, I don't think we've ever talked extensively about this this title, so you might not like me anymore after I say this, but the most nominations, 19, went to Game of Thrones.
No, let me tell you,
it's a fine show.
It's horrible.
But I don't think it even comes close to these.
Horrible. Let me tell you, not only is it not a fine show, we discussed it briefly once because it was so depressing to even mention that when we talked about it, it had more viewers, I think, for the scene where everybody was killed at the wedding than the finale of, I don't know, Breaking Bad, something. What is with this? I mean, I understand it's a great period piece.
That is also a young person's show. I mean, everybody in college and 20-something are obsessed with Games
of Thrones. Oh, my students love it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think, you know, I can only take so much blood and guts. It's too bloody and gutsy for me.
Well, except, see, I thought that was my excuse originally, was the blood and guts thing. And then I say The Sopranos is probably my favorite drama of all time.
Different.
Breaking Bad is my second favorite of all time. I mean, unbelievably gruesome, at least in some scenes. So there is an age divide there that's huge, unlike some of these other series, isn't there?
There is. It skews much younger, and the real fans are in the perfect sweet spot, the demographic that everybody would like, even though there's no advertising on it. It's a pay cable thing. But I think one of the things maybe that we don't like, I'll speak for myself, one of the things for me is that show is so complicated that it never really manages to work. It doesn't have time to work anything out in great detail because it's bouncing between so many characters. Maybe, though, it's just that as we get older, we can process less information, and I just can't keep the plots on that thing straight. I've seen every episode, some of them more than once, and if you were to give me an exam right now and to ask me, who resides at this castle and who's this person, I think I would probably fail it.
You know,
I know enough that I can watch the show and enjoy it, but I don't have the ability, whereas if you gave me a True Detective or a Breaking Bad or a Fargo quiz, I could tell you way more than it's even healthy that I should know.
We're talking to Bob Thompson from Syracuse. You know, Bob, almost every time we have you on, either when we're talking to you or before or after, we talk about how does he do it? I mean, how do you – you just mentioned you've seen all the Game of Thrones episodes.
Some more than once.
And there's this great piece by Emily Nussbaum a couple of weeks ago in TV at the Gym, it's called, in The New Yorker, about how certain shows, as a TV critic, she watches in certain places because it sort of fits the atmosphere. Some on her phone, some on the treadmill at the gym, some at home. Do you break down your TV watching in the same sort of way? Because obviously your responsibilities are immense. How do you do it?
Well, to some extent, I mean, there's so much of it I just have to do. It's just like any job. You've got to do it whether you feel like it or not. But there is a sense that you do try to break some of it down into certain, you know, when you're in the mood. For example, remember 6 Feet Under?
Oh, sure.
Yes.
I had to be in, there were a lot of mental situations I was in where I couldn't watch that show. That was a tough show to watch. So that one I tried to do when I was relatively psychically healthy because I knew I wouldn't be after the episode was over. But that nice Nussbaum piece was interesting to me in that she talks about how she almost uses these mindless shows like NCIS as a sorbet to clear her palate of Breaking Bad and all the good shows. The very first article I ever published in my career was back in 1983, I think it was, the Journal of American Culture. And back then, every single thing on television was what Nussbaum described. You could be half asleep and still understand it. You could walk in halfway through and have no problem getting what was going on. The kid could be screaming and you wouldn't hear the sound. Practically every TV show on the air at that point had that idea because that's how people watch television. It was background noise on a piece of furniture in the middle of domestic space. And back then, and there was a few things. Hill Street Blues had just come. So there was a few shows that had begun to move us toward where we are now, but not very much. And that whole article was an attempt to defend television by saying, look, this is what it has to do, and therefore it has to be very, very good at it. It was titled Love Boat, High Art on the High Seas, and it was an argument that the Love Boat was a true masterpiece because it did what it had to do brilliantly. And now, oddly enough, we've got people writing in these fancy magazines where they're rediscovering what little is left of good old-fashioned, what we used to call dumb television. And there's not much of it left, by the way.
Well, I have to say, some of the situation comedies that win awards all the time that I've seen maybe only once after they win an Emmy and I go back and watch them, I think qualify as dumb television. I mean, it's just... what's the name of the thing? What's the name of the guy? This is horrible because now I'm not going to be able to think. What's the name of the comedy series that was, most people say, the best comedy series of the last decade? What's on broadcast television? What's it called?
Oh, Modern Family, probably.
Oh, Modern Family is great, but it's not Modern. In any case, I'll think of it for next time. And
Big Bang Theory?
I don't know. I don't know what everybody's talking. I have no idea what it is. I'm glad I brought it up, though, Bob.
I know it's not according to Jim.
Okay. Hey, Bob, it was a pleasure as always. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
That was fun. Thank you.
As always, Bob Thompson is the founding director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Thanks, Bob. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Juliet Kayyem. Brian McCreath and Ron Della Chiesa join us for a Tanglewood preview. And Brian McGrory is here from the Boston Globe. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, engineer John Parker, and our intern, Devin Karambulis. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening, and please listen again tomorrow.